This is the Edisto TV podcast, connecting the Blackwater region.
And welcome back to the Edisto TV podcast. This is episode 8. I'm Hugo.
And I am Tom.
And coming up this week, we're going to have an interview with Scott Rome, who joined us on the paddle down the North Fork a few days ago. Tom and I are going to be talking about some of the seasonal low flows that we've heard reported and talked about on the Edisto. Upcoming also, the interview with Vince Furtick. I think it's probably going to lap over a couple of weeks, but we talked this week with Vince about his family and his lifelong connections with the South Fork of the Edisto. And we're also going to update some information on the Edisto TV Technology Initiative. Any of those spark any thoughts, Tom?
Yeah, the water level in the river is very low, and a lot of people are concerned about it. We've had a few people, you know, suggest that the potato farm's causing it in the South Fork, but it's low everywhere. So I don't think anybody's really pointing fingers, but we've also, you know, brought it to the attention of folks at DNR, and they're done a little bit of studying. We've got more information on all that stuff. But anyway, the water is low. People are upset. The Little Salcahatchie River is basically comes to a stop, like the Colorado, like you always see those pictures. So people are very concerned. It's that time of year that, water is sparse, and people are starting to raise concerns about our rivers.
All right. Hold that thought, and we'll go into that in more detail in a few minutes. For right now, let's get started by listening to some of the interview that we did on Skype with Scott Brome end of last week. Scott was kind enough to come along with us and provide some adult supervision as we made our way down the North Fork. And it's interesting to have another perspective on some of these things that we do. So here is Scott Brome talking with Tom and I. I will mention Tom was on location, as we say in the trade, which explains some of the background noise when you hear Tom on mic.
One of the things that you were crazy, I mean, nice enough to do with me was on New Year's Day of 2013, you and I and another guy, Joe Woodard, paddled the headwater stretch of the North Fork upstream of me here. I think it was about a mile and a half of river, and it took us right at 6 hours. With that in mind, what were you thinking when you agreed to go paddling with me again?
Perhaps it was a lapse of reason. Now, you may also remember where I snookered you into an adventure on the Edisto, an Edisto trip that was down near Orangeburg that was only supposed to take 2 or 3 hours, that took about 8 hours.
I think there might be a lot of stories like this.
Starting to notice a trend, especially on these upper stretches of the Edisto and trips taking longer than expected.
Yeah, well, and tell me your impressions of the trip that we took this past Thursday down the stretch where the trestle of the old Swamp Rabbit Railroad crosses. Have you paddled much on the North Fork this high up, apart from these couple of times you and I have gone?
That's about it for me. There is the paddling guidebook, Paddling South Carolina, and I remember a picture in there of some folks on an Edisto trip, and the caption was, "And a safari on the Edisto." It's more of a jungle adventure than what most people picture as a paddling adventure, where you get in a boat and you float and you propel the boat and you keep propelling the boat through the water until you're done. This was, as a friend of mine described, a trip to Congaree Swamp once. We went climbing trees with our canoes.
Yeah, I was explaining to people that basically it was as if you looked at a tree and thought, you know, I'm going to climb that, but let me go get my boat first.
There was some waiting involved. We have to remember there was waiting. And there were some stretches where we may have paddled in excess of 100 yards without climbing a tree.
Yeah, but we made up for it afterwards. If folks want to see some of what we're talking about, Tom put a nice gallery of pictures up on the Edisto TV website.
I got to take a look at a few of those. That captures it pretty well, except for there should have been more pictures of climbing.
And bugs.
I came home rather itchy, but I can't blame most of it on bugs or on plants that might induce itches. Mine was due to the fiberglass fuzz on the bottom of my boat that normally don't encounter, except when I'm climbing trees and dragging a canoe with me.
I understand that all of this just leads to the building of character. Speaking of that, I know Tom had mentioned that you were working on a classification system for obstacles and hazards encountered in paddling the North Fork.
These aren't unique to the Edisto. There's a lot of blackwater streams in this area, and probably lots of other areas that have similar kinds of obstacles. But we might use this as a new way of describing prepositions. We could say what a boat can do to a log on a river. We had the general classes. I define them in major classes of overs, unders, throughs, and arounds. And in the over class, we had the scoot overs, being one that a log that you could scoot over or slide over without actually getting out of the boat. That might include the techniques of knuckle walking, paddle pushing, or rocking the boat. The next one up would be in increasing difficulty would be the drag over or step over. The log assignment that you have to get out of the boat, but you can slide the boat without actually lifting it. And the log might be dry on top. And maybe this is a finer distinction. We had the drag overs that involved a straddle, where you might not be able to just step out. You might have to sit on the log or straddle the log and slide the boat over. And moving to the under class, we had lots of limbos, variations on the limbo, where you could duck forwards or backwards to get under the log. You might have to pull yourself through. It might be wise to check for critters or poison ivy as you're doing so. You may frequently end up with parts of the rotting tree in your boat. We had the throughs. I thought of that as a bulldozing type of maneuver. You might just be able to push through branches, but you might also have to cut or chop. Hugo demonstrated the fine art of using an axe while in a boat and not chopping the actual boat. It seemed to happen when we had trees that were more recently fallen. The branches, the smaller limbs hadn't rotted or fallen off yet. And then the last classification would be the arounds, where you just couldn't go over it or under it or through it. You had to go around it.
Outstanding. And unfortunately, Tom shot some video of us demonstrating some of the techniques you just described. I've had to come to grips with the fact that if I'm going to make this Edisto Expeditions video project, pride is going to have to be set aside.
There's not a lot of room for pride in a river that shallow and that obstructed.
This is the Edisto TV podcast, connecting the Blackwater region.
I would like you to talk about your GPS and some of the stats and things. I think I kind of mentioned that when Hugo and I were talking about it, but anything you've got as far as specific statistics, you put in an email, maybe you can just talk about what you saw out of the GPS and how relevant is that?
And my grace, emphasize my grace.
No pressure here. I'm trying to think. I'm thinking really the most the statistics that I can relate really are the distance and the time. I mean, you could look at the map and that would be interesting. Let's see, maximum elevation is 113 meters and minimum elevation 77. We didn't move 80 feet vertically. Actually, in feet that's 120 feet. We didn't move 120 feet vertically. And the trip total, we got 4.3 miles. And I'm going to pull up the map itself. I think that it's a pretty crooked line. I think that's
a... Yeah, I thought one of the... And if you don't mind us putting it up... Tom can put the track image up on the show notes, but I thought one of the very interesting things that I learned from looking at the GPS track superimposed on the map is the river we paddled and the river shown on the map are not in the same places.
I found that interesting, too. I noticed that. It's like, I don't know, you know, when that map was done, but, you know, I think the river, I think it changes quite often.
Well, and for a river of this nature, where it's sitting down in a floodplain, and it's a pretty small river, that doesn't surprise me. And how did they collect that mapping information? Was it something that was flown over and stereographically figured out, or was it satellite imagery where they... I don't see how you could see the actual stream itself from any visual imagery overhead. There were some
my guess on that stretch, because it forms the Aiken County-Lexington County line, is that they are probably using whatever the official county line survey is. You know, living here on the North Fork, right where we put in, the river has crawled a good bit to the east, right there at the put-in point, since I've been here, since 2005. It's probably moved over 15 feet or so.
I think a lot of times we think of these streams and these geographical features as being pretty fixed, but they aren't, and especially in this sandy geography. It's easy to move.
Well, and paddling at higher water than we had this past week, you know, a lot of the little cut-throughs, they call them sucks, where the water washes across an oxbow and mm-hmm. straightens out a bend, you know? Mm-hmm. Those things, when you see them at higher water, they're very dynamic, and you can see how you could lose an entire oxbow that would just turn into a, you know, slough to the side in a day or two of really heavy water flow. Once those things start to wash, they just start going.
And speaking of, you know, things moving and changing, we certainly were seeing trees that had fallen, some very recently and some that had fallen a long time ago. And that's evidence of that erosion. You know, that stuff on the outside of the bend seemed to be, of course, where, you know, the water coming around the bend is eroding out at the roots and the base of the trees, and then they fall in and cross the river and start to divert the water. And I find it interesting just to watch that process of trees falling and being replaced and affecting the river itself.
Yeah, in fact, I think one of the video clips that Tom recorded shows us going behind what was the root ball of some fallen trees, because they fell from the outside of the bend into the river, and then the bend widened behind what was formerly the roots of the trees.
And there was one case, or one place that I think I pointed out, where I thought was unusual, is that we were in the water and saw a root ball, because typically they're falling into the river, and that one had fallen away. So, you know, usually we would have to be on land to walking around like you just described, to go around behind one. But every so often one will, I guess, fall the wrong way with maybe due to wind.
I really appreciate you and Tom both humoring me and coming on the expedition to find the swamp rabbit with me. Coming up in the next few weeks, we're probably going to go down and paddle with Mr. Bell down in Bamberg on one of his third Saturday trips. And if you'd like to join us for that, I think it might be a little less adventurous, but hopefully a whole lot of fun.
I am planning to make that, and I'm advertising it to our YMCA Indian Guide and Trailblazer groups. And I've got a few people who sound interested, and hopefully will be joining us for that trip. These are folks that we've dragged along on numerous river trips, including that one of those previous trips down the Edisto.
Outstanding. Well, I look forward to seeing y'all down there. I believe it meets at Bobcat Landing there on the third Saturday of July.
All right, and that was our interview with Scott Brome. Tom, let's wrap up the topic of our paddle down the North Fork in search of the Swamp Rabbit Trestle. Any parting thoughts on that?
Well, definitely check out the pictures online. If you go to Edisto TV and you go to the photo galleries, there's probably, I loaded 10 or 15 pictures of our trek through and over and around trees that happen to be in the river. But it was a really good trip, and I think Scott also shared some U.S. or some GPS data that a lot of people had some comments in particular about the vertical data, meaning we were spending a lot of time going up and down as opposed to just floating on a river.
Absolutely. And I will mention also that there is some video that Tom shot. I also shot a little bit of video, and I'm going to get a clip edited and get it up on the are we putting that on the Edisto TV website, or are we putting that on the YouTube channel and linking it? I don't know. We'll figure that out.
Yeah.
You'll be able to access it from either place, and we hope you enjoy that. I thought some of the images that we captured were interesting, if not particularly flattering. Also, during the conversation that we had with Scott Brome, Tom, I know that y'all had a sort of side conversation. Turns out that Scott is our podcast listener number one, and we had a bit of conversation about how people consume podcasts and what kind of apps and so forth you might be able to use to enjoy your podcasting experience more. We're going to cut that out. Didn't make a lot of sense to put podcast listening tips on the podcast, so we're going to have a link where folks can come to the Edisto.tv website and get a little background on how they might go about consuming the podcast content.
For more information and archive podcasts, visit us at edisto.tv.
Tom, let's talk a bit more about what we got into at the outset, which is this seasonal low flow issue. Now, the way that this sort of came to be a topic of fairly widespread conversation was a few weeks ago now. People had mentioned this to Tim Rogers of Fred, and on behalf of Friends of the Edisto, Tim then sent a letter to the folks at DHEC and DNR asking for a little bit of information about what might be causing the low flows and whether they were cause for concern, whether there was a possibility that agricultural withdrawals were having an effect on the amount of water in the river. And I know that there is sort of information coming back from those agencies, you know, as they manage to answer different aspects of it. The overwhelming impression that I get is that this is what they refer to as seasonal low flow. It's not directly attributable to any single or group of agricultural withdrawals, and that just because it is an undammed, free-flowing Blackwater River, levels go up and down, and at the moment they're down. Any thoughts on what we've heard so far, Tom?
Yeah, just rain. Pray for rain. I mean, if you get rain, then the water flows into the river and the river level goes up. That's pretty much as simple as it is for the most part. Does taking, you know, hundreds of thousands or hundreds of millions of gallons out of the river have an effect? Of course it does. Everybody who takes a drop out of the river is having an effect. So everything we take out of the river has an effect. That's simple as that.
It is true, however, that you know, we were quick to make a lot of noise when we had concerns about the big potato farm, for instance. And there does not seem to be at this point any indication that their withdrawals are what's causing the current low flows in the river. It's just that's the character of the river. And if you look at historic data, there are seasonal low flows this time of year.
Yeah, I've been looking at this. I'll put a link on the show notes to the USGS station at Denmark, which is the one where the closest one to us downstream. And you see a big drop roughly around this time of year every year. And the last several years have been really bad. And so it's just normal is what we're hearing is it's just normal to have this kind of drop off, but people are concerned. And I mentioned the Salkehatchie. The Little Salkehatchie River, they're telling me, and supposedly there's some pictures around that I haven't seen yet, but it actually come to the end of a flow where it basically has stopped flowing in the lower portions, and there's a lot of water being withdrawn from that river. So we just sometimes you get a look at something, you say, wow, that could be us in the future, and so we have to be considering that.
Something else on these low flows is one of the people at DNR who's been responding to the information request from Friends of the Edisto is Bill Marshall. And we were talking to Bill when he was out at Blackwater a few weeks ago. and have invited him to be on the podcast, and he has said that he's willing to do that. So as soon as we can, we'll have Bill on, and we can get a bit more of the DNR perspective on these flow issues.
Hey, this is Tom from the Edisto TV podcast. Just putting in another word for Tyler Brothers. As we approach deer season, it's time to get outfitted with the guns, the ammo, the camouflage gear, the snake boots, whatever it is you need to get outdoors and get hunting again. Think about your loved ones. We need to get them outfitted properly for this deer season. Check out Tyler Brothers on the web at tylerbrothers.net. Or you can visit them in Wagner. Tyler Brothers since 1904. Stay away from those big box stores. Check out Tyler Brothers.
And welcome back to episode 8 of the Edisto TV podcast. We talked to Vince Furtick. I mentioned this as a little promo for this week's episode and last week's episode. But Vince and his family have been here since before the Civil War. And so we had a conversation with Vince about his family's historic ties to the area and some of that stuff. So we're going to have that piece of our conversation with him in this week's podcast. But carrying over to next week, he also has an interesting perspective on water use issues because he's a farmer and he lives and owns land next to the Edisto River. So this week we're going to talk about his family's lifelong connections with the area and the river. Then next week we're going to get down to some nitty-gritty about how he feels about these water withdrawal issues.
Yeah, the story of Stockhaven Nursery, which is the farm that Vince operates over there near Springfield, is pretty neat. And so we'll just let him tell himself.
Okay, so here's that interview with Vince Furtick.
I can tell you that my grandmother was a Kennerly, and my grandfather, obviously a Furtick, we came from the Furticks over near St. Matthews. And my grandfather, in this area here is where he farmed, and he's farmed here all of his life. And as far as I know we go back 5 generations back on this particular tract of land. But like I said, the Furticks came from the St. Matthews area, and my grandmother was a Kennerly. My grandfather actually ran off with my grandmother, and when he came back, her daddy told him, said, "Boy, you done played hell now." That's what he said, and evidently it worked out because my daddy is the youngest of 8. And all of those children were born here in this house, and except for my daddy. Now, my daddy was, his mama was approaching 50, as I understand, when he was born, which was unheard of in those days. And when he was born, the doctors told my grandmother that she'd never see him, even a year old. But she lived a long life, and I knew her. And played. She taught me some piano when I was a youngster. But we've been here a long time. We've almost always been farmers. The field that I'm talking about, I know that at one time it was farmed for asparagus. As I understand, Williston was one time the asparagus capital of the world, and they would go down into the swamp and get the Spanish moss and pack the asparagus. And there's still some old asparagus knives here, and there's a lot of volunteer asparagus still around the edges of the field. But I know we've had cows on that field. There's been hay on that field. There's been corn, soybeans, and cotton on this land that's around here. I'm very attached to this land that's here. I consider land more valuable than money, and because they're not making any more land, and they print money every day. It's something that you, I don't know. I work this land every day. When we get off the phone, I'm gonna get on my tractor, which I've done for the last 4 days, running probably and bush hog and take care of my trees. And the land, the water is very important. We're so close to the river. When I grew up, that's what we did when it rained. You know, we went to the river and went fishing. And we typically squealer fishing. We catch catfish on the bottom, I used to walk down to the river, and it's like I say, it's only about 2 miles, and I'd walk down there, and there used to be a little store there at Coop's, and I'd buy some bubble gum or something, and you know, throw rocks and sticks in the river and walk on back. Wouldn't think of doing that these days, but back then we didn't even think about it. We just did, just played out here, and you know, the river has always been special to us, and we love it, and don't want to think about it going away, but we're really attached to it. You know what I'm saying? It's part of us. I'm not a historian, but what I do know is that my grandfather was born in the house here that I'm used for an office in 1896. That's Robert Maury Ferdick, like I said, born in 1896. And he told us the story when we were small about the story that I guess his grandfather told him as the troops came through. And I don't know if this would have been 1864 or 65, because I know he left, Sherman left Atlanta in November of 1864, so this would have been, I guess, later on. But anyway, as his grandfather had told him that the news of the troops coming was kind of spreading throughout the country, I guess the skirmish line as it came down through, they understood that, you know, they were coming, and they kind of explained, the news traveled about what they were doing. And this house that I'm sitting in, it sits right in front of a field. It's actually all part of the same tract of land, but this field's a big 50-acre field. And when I was a kid, you could look across that field, and you could see, my dad had cows there, and you could see the fence posts, bottom of the fence posts across on the back side of the field, and it just looks like a large, flat field, like most of the land in this area is. But near the back of that field, there's a depression. What formed it, I don't know. It could be a glacial moraine or, you know, a meteor hit. Who knows? It's just a large depression. And before the practice that we have of subsoil in the land, back in the they only had a bottom plow, and that particular area would hold water down inside of it. So when the troops came through, the story that my grandfather told me is that they had some of the hands, or the slaves probably at that point, took all of the livestock down into this hole to hide them. And it would be a very effective way to do that, because I've watched tractors go into that hole, and the sound goes away, the tractor goes away, you know, you can't see it or hear it or anything, and they would have had water, so they could have stayed there for an extended period of time. And obviously it would have been, you know, depending on what time of year it would have been, they would have been grazing down there as well. So they took all the livestock down in there when the troops came through, and they actually fed the soldiers out the back of the house, which is probably the reason the house is still standing. You know, it's amazing this hole is there, and that they thought enough to take the livestock down into this hole to save them, because what the troops didn't eat, they would probably kill, as they were trying, you know, obviously causing as much destruction as possible as they did come through. But I mean, it probably wasn't all bad, but I'm just, you know, that was pretty smart to think ahead. Hey, we got to put them somewhere, and we don't really know where. So, you know, this hole out in the middle of a field that nobody knows is there worked pretty effectively. That's why we call our nursery Stock Haven, because of that event that was, you know, told to my grandfather. And we like to think that we still have a little bit of ingenuity in the Ferdick line as well. Right on. I don't know if I'd have thought to do that, but yeah, as I understand, let's see, now we're about 2 miles from what's called Davis Bridge on the south Edisto. And as I understand, they crossed at Ginyard, or close near to Ginyard, which is only about 2.5 miles from here.
I hope y'all enjoyed that. And like I said, Vince had a lot to say also about his perspective on water withdrawal issues as a local farmer. So we'll be back next week with some of that stuff. Tom, one other thing I want to get in before we get out of this week's episode of the Edisto TV podcast is the pilot project for the Edisto TV Technology Initiative. We were hoping to get going on that in late summer. Can you update us on where we stand on that?
Yeah, we knew there was a good chance of some delays from Atlantic Broadband. They're pulling cable, and of course they have a lot of different moving parts to that project. But we're looking at probably a little later than what we had originally said. I think we said August, maybe September. Now it's looking more like October-ish. So that would be, just to be clear what's going on here, Atlantic Broadband is bringing fiber to the home in Wagner, Perry, Sally, and Springfield. Now, people don't understand, fiber to the home is something that, you know, there's only a handful of cities, you know, anywhere that have this kind of internet service. So we're really privileged, even though it's kind of like we're leapfrogging, you know, we were kind of behind. Well, now we're going to be ahead. And I hope that the folks in these areas will take advantage of it. We're certainly hoping to take advantage of the accessibility of the fiber to get it to the rural areas outside the town limits. In most big cities, you have fiber, but it comes in to a local central office for the phone company, and then they parse it out as DSL, or it comes into a cable company, and then they parse it out through coaxial cable to the door. So that's why people don't have fiber to the premise or fiber to the front door. But as strange as it sounds, we're going to have that in Wagner, Perry, Sally, and Springfield. And again, the town of Sally right now doesn't even have DSL. So we're talking about taking a giant step.
Absolutely, and looking forward to seeing that step taken. So while we understand that some delays are inevitable, we encourage our friends at Atlantic Broadband to bring it to us as soon as they can.
And get it right.
All right, moving along, that's pretty much brought us to the end of what we've got on tap for episode 8 of the Edisto TV podcast. I will mention, though, I know it's been several weeks, Tim Rogers has promised that at some point he is going to make himself available to talk about the Blackwater event and also just about things Friends of the Edisto related more globally. So we're looking forward to that. I know he's got a lot going on personally right now, so we're going to cut him a break and not harass him too much. But when Tim is able to take a few minutes, we are going to have him on the podcast. I know I've promised that before, but when I talked to him last, he said he was very sorry, but he will be with us just as soon as an opportunity presents itself. And that's it for episode 8 of the Edisto TV podcast. Hope you've enjoyed it, and we'll see you back here next week.
This is the Edisto TV podcast, produced by Edisto TV, connecting the Blackwater region.